Shrug family, this week on Barbell Shrugged, we are talking about the coolest thing ever. Me! I'm kidding. We brought my coach, Dr. Michael T. Nelson, onto the show. Periodically on the show, we've talked about my pursuit of running a six-minute mile. And today, we're bringing on the guy that I hired to help me do it. If we could just figure out how to make it warm outside so that I could get to the track more often. Instead, it's like freezing, and it feels like your lungs are going to close on you as soon as you start breathing heavy out in the what feels like frigid weather. I know all the people up in the Northeast or in the northern states are going to be laughing at me, but it's cold here in North Carolina right now, and it makes me not want to go outside and run fast because it hurts my lungs. But we're going to go through kind of like what I've been up to for the last six-ish months working with Dr. Mike, the training program he has me on, how we're balancing strength, conditioning, sprinting for high-level output, the VO2 max training, how we're doing zone 2 work to supplement, and really just breaking into all things training on how you would want to kind of structure a pursuit of running a six-minute mile. As always, friends, you can get over to rapidhealthreport.com. That's where Dan Garner and Dr. Andy Galpin are doing a free lab lifestyle and performance analysis that everybody inside Rapid Health Optimization will receive. You can access that video, and you can access that report over at rapidhealthreport.com. Friends, let's get into the show. Welcome to Barbell Shrugged. I'm Anders Warner, Doug Larson, Coach Travis Smash, Dr. Michael T. Nelson. My coach on the show today on Barbell Shrugged, we're talking about the most important person in the world, me, and my most important thing, my training. Why I hired Dr. Michael T. Nelson to get me to run a sub 6 minute mile at the age of 40 years old, which we still have that goal. We still are going to do that before April 26th of 2025.
Is that new ground for you, by the way? Have you done sub six in the past?
I've run in my own training. Oh, this was actually, we did a full show on this in the first quarter of COVID.
I remember.
That was the only place that you could go to socially distance and still do fitness was the track.
That's when you got kicked off the track at the high school, right? They're like, get out of here.
And dude, you're
like,
the same guy called the cops on me. I had to talk to Mike. The same middle school athletic director called the cops on me again, like 2 months ago, and came out and took a picture of my license plate and was like, I'm turning you in. And I was like, why is it so illegal to run in ovals? Like, why is it? I'm by myself. How in the world is this illegal?
Yeah. It's like the middle of a school day. The kids aren't there. You're not
booting kids off the track for you to run.
the time that he did it, the football team was there. They're like in the middle. Nothing else is going on. And he came over and I was like, dude, he may not have liked the comment where I said, I feel like we're over-exaggerating your powers here at the local track. Like, you should not be escorting me anywhere right now. But I left. He got a picture of my license.
Is it a public school?
Yeah. It's a middle school.
Oh, so he works for you. And he escorted you off the thing.
It's a middle school. The football team was out there. Like, what are you going to do with the football team? Anyways, what I want to do today is walk through kind of like the high level. When you hear some slightly above average athlete like myself wants to run a sub 6 minute mile, which he's never done before. I believe the best I've ever done leading up to this was 6:30, which I did during COVID. And it was like 6:30 right on the button. But I had all I was doing was just go fast, go to the track, random intervals, and giddy up and go. There was no like real rhyme or reason outside of like, I just needed to get out of my house. And the track seemed like a really good place. But when a 40-year-old with a decent athletic history and is in decent shape comes to you with a high goal of a 5:59 mile, where do you kind of start this process?
I mean, I start with where are they currently at, which is, it sounds so simple, but I've gotten burned on this in the past where I took people at their word and you ask them, how is your form? Oh, it's great. Yeah. And then you realize, like, if you use a simple 1 RM max, that they were off by 80 pounds and about 6 inches high on their squat. So I've always said just getting some, not really proof, but just a current assessment of where they're at. Because if you don't have that, then your programming is going to be off to start. So once you have that, then with something like your goal, I divide it into, is there kind of a conditioning aspect? And then what is the technical component? And then I'll usually try to separate those as much as possible initially, because you can work on the technique stuff, but you're probably not going to run a mile in great technique. So lesser difference distances, keeping good technique, you know, doing things like, you know, people have classically trained sprinters for decades and longer. And the conditioning aspect, of course, if you can run, that's going to be more specific. But like we'll get into, there's going to be some constraints. So maybe you could do a bike, you could do a rower, you could do other things so that you're still working within that person's constraints of what they have to get them to their goal. Because not everyone, like we said, is going to have access to the track every single day and can, you know, spend hours doing their warm-ups and their perfect drills and everything else. Like you have to operate within their real world constraints too.
Yeah.
So wait, what was the testing that you ended up doing with Anders? Did you just say, go run a mile and tell me your time and then we'll take it from there? Or yeah. Yep. Wait, so what was the initial time? Do you remember?
We did the Cooper test, and that was actually what inspired it. Go ahead. I'll let you go.
Yeah. I was going to say, so we would do a specific test, which would be like a 1 mile, like where are you at right now? And then for conditioning, I'll tend to do a VO2 max test. So you can either do a 2K on the Concept 2 rower, or in this case, running is going to be more specific. So you can do a 12-minute Cooper run test, take 12 minutes, run as far as you can within those 12 minutes, boop up, type it in online, and it'll give you what your VO2 max is. So your volume of oxygen, kind of a marker for how big is your aerobic engine. And then you can look at those two and see, okay, which of those two needs, you know, more work. If your technique looks good and your time isn't, you know, super far off, but your VO2 max is like the status of a field mouse and you're in the 20s, you're like, wow, you're some sort of weird genetic freak where we just get your aerobic base a little bit better, you're probably going to be fine. Or most people are a mix. Like the aerobic system is probably pretty good, but they probably need a combination of some specific technique work also.
What about like the lactate threshold or just the anaerobic system? Because with the mile, that's going to come into play.
Yeah, then the next, I would say that would be the next level down. So you can do things on the rower, you can do them on the bike, you can do running, and just see kind of what are your split times, what are your pace. And then if you don't have a fancy way of pricking your finger to get a lactate reading, I just kind of do RPE and see where you're at. For people listening, like the 400 meter is probably like the worst possible race to do because your lactate levels are so high, but it's just long enough to start accumulating a lot of lactate, but it's not long enough where you still have to run pretty darn fast. So you can break it up into just, you know, kind of 200 meter components and see where they kind of fall off or where they just report that, yeah, that was good. That was good. Oh my God. That was like, you know, horrible. So if they report like the 400 meter was like the worst possible thing ever, okay, maybe we'll do a little bit more lactate, you know, specific work. And like, you know, you can get hyper specific and plot out, you know, different types of, you know, lactate testing and get really granular from there.
Yeah.
To add a little context for someone like Anders, though, probably I think what you did was be perfect. Like you don't need to do the finger pricking, you know.
No.
Especially so we all know he came from CrossFit. So probably pretty good lactate threshold, I bet.
Yeah, and you can do, I use the rower as a surrogate because especially if some athletes, not Anders, I don't really trust them to run real fast, you know, in terms of mechanics. So I'll be like, hey, get on the rower, do 30 seconds all out as hard as you can, do 60 seconds all out. And if I want to be really torturous, do 180. So you're basically doing short, medium, and long, you know, that 3 minute, all as hard as you can. So as soon as you start, you're going as hard as you can for those 3 minutes.
It's awful. It's what I've been doing a lot of. It's killing. Yeah.
And you can look at those three differences by pace because the rower is going to give you all that information. It's also non-impact. So that's kind of an easy way back of the envelope. You can kind of get at it.
Another way, another reason why I've chosen the rower just in my hip. And so the rower is a great way to get in conditioning if you have hip issues.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. A lot of people just can't take that impact, and I don't want them blowing a hamstring on day one doing a 60-second wind gate or something crazy.
Cracking a femur neck like me.
the Cooper test that we did really was my main goal was to get on like a conditioning program because lifting at the time had gotten kind of like stale, like it does over time.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did the Cooper test, it's 12 minutes max distance. And I didn't get kicked off the track that day, but I went and I timed the mile. And knowing that I still had to get to 12 minutes, I hit the mile at like 7:10 or something like that, knowing mm-hmm. I still had 5 minutes to go. And I went, I bet if I crush this thing, I could go 6:30 today without even thinking about it. And then
what happened?
I got to do is knock off 6:30 to 6 minutes by actually training. And that said, that was when I was like, this is now the goal. Can I run a 5:59 at 40? It was during that Cooper test when I went, basically ran a 7 minute mile, knowing I still had 5 minutes left with like tons left in the tank. And I was like, I bet I can get there.
Yeah. And that's a good part is you want goals that the person for them personally are going to want to do regardless of what anyone else thinks, because that is going to be their biggest intrinsic motivator. And that's one of the reasons I do a fair amount of testing and assessments is many times, like you said, they'll come up with, oh, wow, my 2K in the Roar really sucks. I want to hit this number now, or I want to hit this for 12 minutes, or I want to run a mile in this. Like they'll come back to me with a specific goal that they want to hit, which is a lot better than me saying, well, I think you should do this or that number. They're going to be a lot more motivated to actually do it.
Yeah. Why do you prefer the rower over the bike?
Shrug family, I want to take a quick break. If you are enjoying today's conversation, I want to invite you to come over to rapidhealthreport.com. When you get to rapidhealthreport.com, you will see an area for you to opt in which you can see Dan Garner read through my lab work. Now, you know that we've been working at Rapid Health Optimization on programs for optimizing health. Now, what does that actually mean? It means in three parts, we're going to be doing a ton of deep dive into your labs. That means the inside out approach. So we're not going to be guessing your macros. We're not going to be guessing the total calories that you need. We're actually going to be doing all the work to uncover everything that you have going on inside you. Nutrition, supplementation, sleep. And then we're going to go through and analyze your lifestyle. Dr. Andy Galpin is going to build out a lifestyle protocol based on the severity of your concerns. And then we're going to also build out all the programs that go into that based on the most severe things first. This truly is a world-class program, and we invite you to see step one of this process by going over to rapidhealthreport.com. You can see Dan reading my labs, the nutrition and supplementation that he has recommended that has radically shifted the way that I sleep, the energy that I have during the day, my total testosterone level, and just my ability to trust and have confidence in my health going forward. I really, really hope that you're able to go over to rapidhealthreport.com, watch the video of my labs, and see what is possible. And if it is something that you are interested in, please schedule a call with me on that page. Once again, it's rapidhealthreport.com, and let's get back to the show.
Why do you prefer the rower over the bike?
I can't find a good, maybe Travis knows this, a good validated, legitimate test on the bike. Like everyone has their own protocols, and there's some debate. A good buddy of mine, Kenneth Jay, did some assessments off of the assault bike and mechanical efficiency, and maybe it's off a little bit, but we know that the Concept 2 did one that's pretty close. I measured it with my own metabolic card here. It's relatively close. So I know that one's been validated by a study. We know the Cooper Run test has been validated. I've used other bike tests, you know, like we had you do some of them, but I can't say that this is compared to a population status where I can look at those two tests and we can have tons of data on the population status for VO2 max. And I can say, hey, you're at the 50% of a population, or you're at the 90th percentile, or with Concept 2, because they have the whole entire logbook of a bunch of crazy people logging all their stuff.
Yeah.
I can show you that out of all the people who are rowing, you're at the 50th percentile. Here's what it would like to be hit the 75th percentile.
Yeah.
I can give them very specific numbers and tell them how they rate to different populations.
And the bike is so variable when it comes to like resistance, even though the rower is kind of too, but it doesn't seem to affect people as much as on the rower as it does on the bike.
Yeah. And a tip for the rower too is most people, you're going to probably want to set your drag factor at 120 to 130. So go into it. And if you just don't, this makes no sense to you, just Google it, because the damper you set on the side will be very different depending upon the condition and the rower, et cetera. All your numbers will still work out. Like it'll still account for it. But if you've ever got on a rower and you're like, man, this rower pulls really hard. Like, woo, this one's like way too easy. If you set that drag factor to the same, every rower you're on now will be feeling the same each time you pull on it.
Same way.
Yeah.
Yep. Right.
For conditioning efforts, I've actually always wondered this. Because there is like a short or like a very small like interval piece to, or like an anaerobic piece almost to the rower, because there's a rest after you pull, does that change kind of the stimulus that you are looking for? Where when you're on the bike, there's no breathing whatsoever. Like there's no rest. Your arms have to be moving, legs have to be moving. There's no pull and then recover.
Well, the aerodyne, recover. Make sure that you clarify. You're talking about an aerodyne.
Aerodyne, right.
There's a big difference in a bike and an aerodyne, yeah.
Yeah, the Rogue assault bike that feels like a German tank is sitting in my garage.
It does.
Thing is a giant monstrosity.
But when you say though, Doc, that like on the rower done properly, there's always like, you know, after you extend, you should be pulling. It should be some hip flexion going on. So there shouldn't be that rest unless you're chilling out. I mean, which you could do that on the bike too if you wanted to, I guess.
Yeah, the assault bike's a weird thing, right? It's like we think of running, right? So you have your arm motion's going to be tapped with your leg motion. Rowing, we kind of get that, okay, your legs and arms work together. And on the assault bike, you're pedaling, but you're also moving your arms back and forth. So it's kind of a weird motion, but you are stimulating a lot of muscle groups. So I think on that, just from a skill level, there's nowhere to, quote unquote, relax. With the rower, you can kind of a little bit, if we just use common parlance of like when the handle gets to you, you do have that kind of split second where it is going to be a little bit weightless. And you can get super far down that rabbit hole. Like I'll stick Moxies on some on their quads, look at how much oxygen is being used by the muscle. And then if I can get them to relax for even a split second to get those vascular beds to open more, get more oxygen, you can do efficiency stuff like that. But on the bike, you're just kind of not efficient by the virtue of the thing, no matter how good you ever get at it.
Well, I love it now. I think we did like a 20-minute test. And I want to say the first half of it, you wanted me doing pure nasal breathing, and then it was just open the floodgates and get after it.
Yep.
I would love to know just kind of the reasoning behind something, a test like that, like one where you're controlling the method at which you're breathing. And then if I'm trying to run a 6-minute mile, like 20 minutes is 2-3 times that length.
Yeah, it's because most of, I would say, a capacity test, like if I use a rower, we'll do like a 20-minute, or for people who are rowers, you can use a 5K. And so I just adapted it to the bike, where I want a long enough period of time where we do want a fair amount of aerobic fatigue to see how much you're going to go off that cliff. Like, do you start great for 5 to 7 minutes and then you're tanked, or can you hold a relatively high wattage for that period of time? You know, biking, you get into, you know, functional power and all this other kind of crazy stuff. But you probably want a fair amount of time to see what happens there. And then I'll limit it by nasal breathing at first to see what is the difference between nasal breathing and if we don't limit you by airflow. If there's a massive difference between those two, then I'm thinking, okay, maybe your efficiency of breathing isn't so good. So we may do a lot of nasal work to try to get that closer to your max, even though it's never going to be your max because you're limiting airflow through your nose versus your mouth. It just gives me an idea of kind of what their breathing patterns are. Because I've had some people where, like, nasal breathing, you know, their max heart rate was 120. And then you tell them just breathe however you can, and they'll hit like 175, you know, versus someone else is like 155. They're trying hard, but they can still nasal breathe. You know, that's a pretty big difference between those two athletes, you know, at that lower end, that nasal breathing where you're purposely capping them.
Yeah. I also, when we're doing like shorter high intensity efforts, I've kind of like found, call it 100 meters, maybe a little bit longer outside my house where I can just rolling start into wind sprints, 5 to 6, 7 reps somewhere in there. My body feels phenomenal. If you are not sprinting in your training, you are missing out on just the amazing feeling that goes along with just being able to feel like you're flying, even though I'm, Mash, how bad did I get beat by Johan?
I was just looking at it the other day, real bad, really bad.
There's nothing. There's nothing better than feeling like you're flying and then knowing what it feels like.
Johan Blake is the second fastest human of all time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was quite amazing.
he got me good.
It looked like it looked like a cheetah chasing down a deer with a broken leg.
Tap tap tap, dead.
Done.
And then at the end of every week, you make me feel like I'm going to want to die. And it's the exact opposite feeling when I'm on an airdyne and you say, go 30 seconds as hard as you possibly can. Why are those, the intervals are, call it roughly the same. I mean, it could be 15 seconds versus 30, but inside 30 seconds, the intervals being the same, the intensity of my output by myself being the same. One of them makes me feel amazing and fast. And the other one makes me feel like I'm going to throw up immediately being on an airdyne going that hard.
Yeah, the reason for that is we're trying to get some basically sprinting mechanics and efficiency. So if you take someone who has the same level of conditioning, but you can increase their mechanics and they can become more efficient, they'll obviously run faster, right? Because their efficiency is better. It's, you know, if you don't always have track access, it's a little bit hard to do that. So when we're doing those short intervals running, the goal is it should feel like you're going fast, but it also should feel like it's relatively, my little air quotes here, easy. Like if you watch 100 meter sprinters in slow motion, like their lips are moving all over the place. Like they are, there's nothing that is excess tension that doesn't need to be tense. Like everything is perfectly timed and it just looks like it. You can watch them finish. You're like, wow, that looked like it was pretty easy. Oh yeah, that like guy or gal just train ran a world record.
I know, they're not even breathing hard. They're just
not even breathing
laughing,
hard.
Ready to talk to the cameras. I'm like, God, yeah, I'd be throwing up. Yeah,
yeah. And so that's what we want for that efficiency, right? Because that's the goal of that session. It's not necessary to add a bunch of fatigue on it. If we add a bunch of fatigue to that, your performance is going to drop, and your form's probably going to go to hell. Now you're just doing a bunch of bad reps, and you're just running around all conditioned. However, if we remove that and we use like the bike where it's not necessarily running on purpose, we can try to develop some of those, you know, that systems that max out around 30 seconds. We're trying to make it more mechanically inefficient, and we're actually trying to do it in something that hopefully won't transfer to sprinting, meaning we're trying to give you a bigger aerobic engine without disturbing and messing up the sprinting mechanics. Oh. So we're going to use a different modality on purpose to do that.
But so after you get the initial testing done with Anders and you kind of figure out what your baselines are and how you want to approach his first mesocycle, what does that first week look like? How do you structure intervals versus longer duration cardio versus keeping some strength training in there, et cetera?
I would say the routine, the split that I use probably 80-90% of the time just to start with people is some lifting Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Again, in this case, it was a little bit different. Some type of conditioning Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday, or at least one day a week is completely off. Like just max unload the system as best you can. Go for a walk, lock yourself in a float tank, do some breath work, whatever. And then within that, the lifting is geared more towards what's missing lower body. He had some upper body goals also. The conditioning then is the higher priority stuff that we think will have the most transfer will then be loaded towards the beginning of the week. So in his case, he'll have Saturday and Sunday off. So the technique stuff would be then we move to Monday in this case, because we want to do it ideally when his nervous system and everything else is as fresh as possible. And then the things, you know, from there got pushed out. If we're looking at, you know, conditioning stuff on a bike, and it can be later in the week. If you have a little bit of fatigue on board, we're not looking for anything technical. You're probably going to be fine. It probably sucks more, but I'm not as concerned about the outputs from those particular sessions. So I usually will do it in terms of a priority arrangement. And then also, you know, my background, I did a master's in mechanical engineering. So I always think of like, what are the constraints on the system? Ooh, I can only get to the track this day, or I can only get to a bigger gym this day. I can use the stuff in my garage this time. I only have this amount of time. So those things you have to operate within whatever their constraints are. And then just, you know, rearrange stuff and do the best you can then.
Anders, from your perspective, after having done this for a number of weeks, like what do you feel like has moved the needle the most out of all the training you've done with Mike to date?
The I feel like people, maybe not people, meatheads in general, neglect movement and think that we're doing a lot of moving when we sit down and stand up with a bar on our back. And we're like, yeah, like I'm athletic. I'm standing in place and squatting. And you don't realize how much your body genuinely wants to get up and go move and breathe. And like it's easy to stay in shape. Lifting weights, you can do it a little bit faster. You can do it a little lighter, a little heavier. There's some variance in there. And like, you can do a zillion different exercises to kind of get to change things up, keep it interesting. But there really is something to getting out and moving and running. And I also think that, maybe even like during my CrossFit career, whatever that means, I don't know if I ever intentionally trained like VO2 max or like did really sustained efforts at high intensity, like on the bike or things like that. It was always just like, I just went and trained with my friends and did workouts. So like being on a structured conditioning program makes your body feel amazing. And I don't like, I can go, I would say all of the like talk about like zone two stuff, obviously like zone two training is very important. I feel like I get all of that running around and playing with my kids at night. Like that's where I do this like elevated heart rate, low intensity thing. Like I'm playing street hockey and trying to play kickball and like just normal life. Exactly. Like it's just live an active life and you don't really have to work. You don't need to hop on a bike and like make sure your heart rate's at 120 to 130 and live in this like rigid thing. Go out and play. Sitting on a bike at maximum intensity for 5 minutes and trying to hit numbers really makes your body feel amazing. It's really hard to hit numbers day in and day out, but there really is something to the cumulative effect of putting a really structured conditioning program together that your body really, really likes being able to pump blood, move oxygen to your muscles, like in a very easy way. And the more you're able to do it, and different, like I don't want to take the words out of your mouth, but we kind of structure like short, high intensity, longer duration, like 1 2-4 mile run a week. And then in there is like the VO2 max training of like 5 minute all out efforts. Can you hit numbers? Can you sustain higher level intensities like RPE 9 plus? And be able to do that. And over time, your body starts to adapt in a very different way than it does when you're just trying to get jacked. And I think it feels significantly healthier for, let's just call it this stage of life that I'm in, where I want to just feel healthy. And I'm not going to like lose a lot of muscle mass. I don't have to worry about getting weak. But there, if you can get on a structured conditioning program where you're consistently doing it, I think that you'll like, many people from the meathead background would, one, benefit, and two, understand how much better they feel when their body is able to just transport oxygen significantly easier on a day-to-day basis.
I think it's mentally healthy too, just to have more measurables other than just force production. Like at least for a power lifter, for me, it's exciting to have multiple variables.
Yeah.
To watch improve. It's like every day it's like, is it anaerobic or is it aerobic? You know, is it strength? Is it speed? Is it power? Like having all these measurables makes the workout so much fun because each day is a little different. It's mentally much healthier.
Yeah. There's kind of like a letting go of that, the like meathead ego side to it and just
ish.
Not all the way. Not all the way. Your boy got the hundreds for six last week. Two sets of six.
That's awesome.
I'm going three dumbbell sets of six press. This week. Dumbbell bench press, so, mash. I got them.
So for everyone listening, you don't have to become a weakling to do this.
Yeah,
like, I'm still struggling on you. So yeah.
Bottom row all the way to the right is where you should hang out on those dumbbells when you go to the Lifetime Fitness. Don't hang out in the top row. But I think that's really been the biggest benefit, Doug, is I really enjoy moving like fast and sprint. There's just no opportunities unless you force the issue in life to need to go sprint. And there's no opportunities just built into normal life where like you got to just giddy up and go. So you need a coach and you need a goal and you got to have somebody that's going to structure it for you. And you really do start to feel significantly better. Just I don't know what exact physiological changes happen when the blood just pumps better, but you can feel it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Last night was the first time in my life where someone actually was trying to beat me with a conditioning test. That's never happened ever. So didn't succeed. And I was like, who am I? But anyway, it was exciting.
Yo, regarding the goal of the 6-minute mile, are there any milestones or benchmarks along the way that you're looking to achieve? And then that's when you say, okay, now's the time to go test and go see if we can do it.
Oh, yeah, 75 degree weather.
that's when you
no,
do it.
No, I really feel like if I were to get to the track right now for a consistent month, I would be very, very close. Like anytime you say like this is the healthiest I've ever felt or whatever that means, you always go back to like a 27-year-old version, peak testosterone, peak like whatever that like growling noise is when you're about to like gnaw on a barbell for an afternoon, like that's always there. If you're like, am I in better shape? But I feel better.
Me too.
And I feel like I can go run sprints on flat ground and not get injured. I can go run a half marathon tomorrow if I needed to. All of those things are like very not intimidating to me at all. And if it was 75 degrees and I wouldn't go to jail right now trying to run around the track, I feel like I would get really close. And we haven't put any track work in at all in the last 2-3 months as the weather's kind of changed.
Mike, what about from your perspective? Like, what are you looking for where you look at Anders and go, like, based on these numbers, you can probably do this now, even though we haven't tested it. Like, I feel very confident that you'd be able to hit it. And where is he at in comparison to whatever those goals might be?
Yeah, and that's, I would say most of that is going to be basically on his feedback. So basically what he just said, because again, you're constraint limited. You can't go out and do any type of testing that would be the 1 mile. But once the weather is better, one of the things I'll have people do if we're not sure, so we're, you know, once the weather is available, you can go run a mile and do it at an RPE of maybe a 7 or an 8. You know, you're not going to go all out. You're going to go, you know, pretty hard, but you're not going to, you know, go balls out on it. And even that will give you a pretty good idea. You know, if you go out and you just say it's an RP of an 8, you're just going to test it, and you're at 7:30. Ooh, yikes. Maybe you're a little farther off than you thought. Or if you're, you know, at 6:30, 6:20, you're like, okay, yeah, that's now you're probably within, you know, striking distance of where you need to be. So I think a lot of sub-max tests that are specific to the goal, I think are highly underrated. And because it's a sub-max, there isn't nearly as much of a risk involved with it either, as opposed to, hey, bro, I think you're ready, and just, you know, ignore how your body feels. Just go balls out and see what happens. And there's a time and a place, you know, to do that type of distress training, but I wouldn't do that as like the first thing. I would do a couple warm-ups. Or if they are going to do that type of thing, I have them do a progressive warm-up where just run a short distance, just go at 50%. Walk back, give me 60%. Walk back, give me 70. Walk back, give me 80. Walk back, give me 90. And if you feel good and everything is operating well and you can slowly scale up to, you know, a max sprint, yeah, rest completely, maybe give the 1 mile a shot on that day, right? Because in his case, we have the luxury of time in that he doesn't have to go out and perform this on Saturday at 10 a.m. at a meet or something like that. So there's no reason to force something when it's not there. I think a lot of people, when it's test day, you know, if they're not competing, they get stuck in their head that they have to go that day. And reality, most people probably don't. If it's not there, it's not there. Pick another day. And then if you're not sure, just run a sub-max test and see where you're at.
Yeah. I think a sub-max test will also make sure that you don't mentally discourage.
Oh, 100%.
Because Anders is motivated intrinsically, but like if you have that person who is just like easily discouraged, that's the last thing you want to do is go out and run the test and they fail and they're going to be like, quit.
So. Yeah. To put some numbers to that, Doug, we before the weather turned, we did 4 quarter-mile repeats, and I want to say that my slowest one was like everything was between 120 and 123. Mm-hmm. So you run those numbers out, and that gets you to like a 520. And now you've got roughly 40 seconds of slowing down slash trying to stay below like anaerobic threshold bonking on lap three. Really is the last one. You can die on the last one, but lap three is the one that you got to kind of watch out for, and make sure you're going slower than anticipated.
How much rest do you get between those quarter miles?
I think we're just doing complete rest, if I remember right. So yeah. One of the things I'll do is, this is back when we had access to a track and it wasn't getting booted out in weird weather. You can take your goal and be like, okay, if you can't do the full mile at that time, could you do a half a mile? Could you do a quarter mile? Could you do an eighth of a mile? Could you give me something that is at that pace or close to? Again, we ran a little bit of a buffer because we're going to have them do repeats, and he said it felt good. How I know I'm developing those qualities specifically. And then if you go complete rest, go back again. So you're trying to hit a certain pace and you're accumulating volume at that pace. And then once right. you can do that, your options are lengthen it and see if you can still hit the same pace. Or now you can do the density method where you're starting to condense them. So now instead of having 3 to 5 minutes between, okay, give me a 3 minute rest, go back, hit that same pace. Okay, give me a 2.5 minute rest, hit that same pace. So you're trying to compress it back together, but you don't want the output to actually suffer. I think that's the mistake people make is they go make it hard, but their output is getting worse. And so what they're training is they're literally training to run slower than what they needed to run, which is fine if you're going to do conditioning, but make that a conditioning thing and make it separate. Don't make it a specific to the goal at that point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk a little bit about the VO2 max training and how people can kind of structure that into their own training. Like, does it need to be 5 minutes? Does it need to be 7, 10? Like, where's kind of like a sweet spot on those intervals for kind of like higher intensity sustained outputs?
Yeah, so most of the literature from my interpretation would say that intervals at a pretty high output, you want probably 2 to 6 minutes, somewhere in there. Where if we just look at, I put up a post about why people should not only do zone 2 training, and like everyone got super pissed at me and put up things of like, why had this guy who was doing 13 hours of zone 2 and it improved his VO2 max and all these weird cases where I was just saying like doing 2 to 3 hours of zone 2 stuff has its benefit. It's good for aerobic base building, but you're probably not going to see a massive increase in VO2 max. Again,
no way.
Having a place to do it, it's useful. So to me, I classify them as zone 2, almost recovery, very bottom of the, you know, aerobic base building. Then the next level up, you have what I call just a cardiac development. Something you can hold at a pretty decent pace for 10, 20, maybe 30 minutes. A little bit higher heart rate, not super max, but it's definitely higher. After that, you're getting into some type of interval VO2 max thing. Pretty high output, 2 to 6 minutes, somewhere in there. Beyond that, you're kind of getting into the wind gates and the short 30, 60 seconds, you know, repeats and that kind of stuff. So most people, I think, would do better if they're already, you know, pretty decently fit, do more cardiac development stuff, and then add just like one session of intervals. The caveat being start with a shorter interval, have it be relatively hard, then repeat that interval, but I will only let them drop the output by maybe 5 to maybe 10% at the absolute max. So you're going to rest as long as you can to hit that, say, 2 minutes again at a very similar output again, rest completely, and hit another one. So you don't, again, similar. You don't want the quality to just drop off so hard because you're not training at then a high enough output to get the adaptation. It'll feel hard when you're doing it, but when you're resting, it almost feels too easy. And so people like to mash everything together and have the whole thing feel difficult. But if you look at their output over the intervals, you'll see interval three was like 40% of interval one. It's like, bro, just rest longer. Like we want to train right. your body. You need to hit these outputs, and are just like lifting. At some point, if you want to get stronger, you have to hit close to your top end weights in order to kind of move that needle. Yes, there's transfer. Yes, some of the other stuff works. But it's the same thing with intervals. If you've got this huge difference between them, then that's probably a little bit too much. And again, over time in an advanced athlete, yeah, maybe you hit a 2-minute interval and you're doing incomplete rest where you're resting for 30 seconds and then you go again. Great. If you can hold that output, awesome. But that's an extremely advanced thing that most people, even getting to a 1-to-1 work to rest ratio, in my opinion, is quite advanced.
Mash, here's your test, buddy. You ready?
Yes.
You got 3 5-minute intervals on the Airdyne, and you got to hit 2 miles on each 5 minutes. See how you can hold up, buddy. Anybody that's listening to the show, that's where I'm at every Wednesday of my life.
That sounds terrible. Like, what's the rest?
It is terrible.
Complete rest?
Huh?
Is it complete rest in between or what?
That would be nice, but you know, we have kids coming home off the bus and I got daycare pickup at 5. So if you start at 4, you run wind sprints start, and then you got three intervals coming your way. It's probably like a 1-to-1, like 5 on, 5 off, somewhere around there. It's not all the way back down to like a resting heart rate, but you're sub 100.
Yeah.
3 5-minute intervals with a goal of 2 miles.
Okay. 2 miles. We did the test. I get very close to it every time. We did the test the other day and it was 2.07 miles in 5 minutes. I was stoked on that.
That's good.
You're a bad man.
That's good.
You're a bad man though.
Now, the things that I, at the very beginning, when I knew that there was some like real changes happening inside me, was when we were doing the like nasal breathing only stuff. And I was, I was able through, I'm trying to read whatever my polar, heart rate monitor, maintaining 160 to 170 beats a minute nasal breathing for 5 minutes is getting after it. That was when I was like, damn, this thing really is different. Like I've never trained in that way. And then being roughly what, 85% of max heart rate, and just breathing through your nose and be able to sustain that at that high intensity was like, I knew things were moving in the right direction.
I've learned so much in this podcast. I've got so many notes and I can't believe I'm taking notes about aerobic training.
What is your life?
Are we all dead? I feel like we're living a dream right now.
Mash is going to sign up for a marathon. Hold on a second.
No, chill out now. Chill out. Yeah, 5K at best.
Mike, can you dig into kind of the science and rationale behind nasal breathing during cardio? Mm-hmm. Like, why is that a thing? Why not just more breathe notes. However awesome. You need to breathe?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of the gear system from Brian McKenzie. You know, at a low intensity, you should be nasal breathing. The next level up would be you can still nasal breathe, but you're putting a fair amount of effort in order to nasal breathe. Then can you breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth? And then at the very end, can you breathe in through your mouth and out through your mouth? If we think about how a lot of athletes I see initially, they're low intensity stuff. They're breathing in and out of their mouth all the time. And I'm like, this is low to moderate intensity. Like, you should not be limited by your airflow. So if you can breathe in through your nose, it's going to be better. You get some filtration, you get a little bit of resistance, which may help with, you know, some respiratory muscle training, some other stuff, who knows. But it's as simple as like use it or lose it. Like, I've done nasal training, just low to moderate intensity with athletes, and then maybe have them tape their mouth at night. And shocker, all of a sudden now during the night, they can start breathing through their nose. Or they'll notice the rest of the day, they can start breathing through their nose. So to me, it's a way to bring some level of awareness and to train them at a little bit higher stress level. And then hopefully that'll transfer to the rest of the day and the rest of their sleep. Well, they will automatically try to switch to more nasal breathing. The caveat is I've seen some max VO2 tests from people and just, I'm like, hey, just send me your raw data. Like, this looks weird. And I'm looking at like their, you know, volumes of air and stuff and their heart rate. And I'm like, what? Were you like trying to do any breathing technique during this? They're like, oh yeah, man, it was a max test. So I was told to nasal breathe the whole time. And I'm like, your max test is limited by your airflow. Like, you were the one who limited your own airflow, right? Mm-hmm. So if it's an all out max, by all means, like you can get more air in, you know, through your mouth. So you don't want to be limited by airflow per se on a max test where it's, you know, 100% about performance. So it's being able to grade those. There was a time and a place for everything. And I think just being intentional about those transitions. And so like some of the stuff we did with Anders, like we may purposely push him really hard and restrict him to nasal breathing only for a period of time. If that was a performance test, though, we probably wouldn't have that restriction on there. Again, you're trying to train these specific things. And then if it's a performance, like, okay, kind of remove some of the limiters at that point. But everyone wants to get into it's either 100% nasal breathing or all that's just, you know, bull crap. You don't need to do it. Just breathe however you want. And shocker, like the answer is both of them can be useful. What are you trying to do? And then I find like doing a max test, like a 2K on the rower, if I can start out nasal breathing, that gives you something to think about. Okay, how long can I do that? Okay, now I'll nasal breathe to mouth breathing. And I also know that if I start shifting to that earlier, ooh, this test is really going to suck, right? And so over time, you can use this as even a mental strategy to know, okay, you know, to the halfway point, I should be able to, you know, easily nasal breathe. But by the end of it, yeah, I'm going to be breathing it out of my mouth 100% just because of the level of fatigue. So I do think it just gives people something to focus on and also a way of moderating things like if you're running where you may not be constantly looking at a GPS or having the feedback of where you're at either, that becomes kind of your feedback independent of heart rate too.
Yeah. One of the things that I started to notice is you almost expect when your output gets higher that you're just going to start panting like you've been doing it your right. whole life, that you're just like, if you run, you just like it's out of your mouth and you're just used to this like panting thing that like kind of feels like that. But when you force yourself to do it through your nose, it requires your nervous system to be calmer mm-hmm. and not feel like you're going to like you need to just gasp for air. And there's definitely a learning curve to it, but once you become okay with that feeling, I don't think it changed much on the performance side at all. No. It was just, now I'm just moving. I'm just on the bike faster. I'm just breathing through my nose. It didn't change the performance. It changes just the method at which the directions are telling me to do it.
Yeah. And I have noticed that higher outputs like on the rower, and I've done this with a couple of people, that if you get to kind of right where your limit is, like you're trying pretty hard and you're still nasal breathing in and out. So I did this a while ago. My heart rate was like 165. And that was definitely the limit. It was pretty hard to stay there. And I would switch to mouth breathing. My heart rate would instantly go up to like 168, 169. My output was the same. I fixed my output the same. So I think there is something where maybe it's a little bit more parasympathetic tone. Maybe it's an efficiency. I'm not sure. But it seems like you do get a little bit lower heart rate for that same output. Again, the caveat being these are all still sub-max. This is not an absolute max test. And during a max test, you don't want that to be the limiter.
In structuring the strength training side of things, we've been very consistent and I've enjoyed all the kind of the strength stuff that we're doing. Is there a like the push and pull kind of like balancing the overall fatigue on lifting and how that then carries over into just like the full recovery and into the next training when really the goal is increasing cardiovascular, call it fitness, health, whatever?
Yeah, the two things I look at there are just overall sort of systemic fatigue and then the transfer also of motor patterns. So if, for example, you said, man, all my sprints lately are just feeling like dog crap. The first thing I would look at is, ooh, what are we doing with lower body loading? Like, are we going to move some of this stuff up? Are we going to go to more split stance stuff, you know, safety bar or front, you know, I would probably look at changing up those types of movements. The thought being maybe that movement pattern is interfering with sprinting. If sprinting is feeling great, you're like, man, everything's feeling good. It's great. Cool. I'm not going to worry about it. It's probably going to be okay. And then also just the overall fatigue, because yeah, if you can get stronger and you can get more power output, that should transfer to sprinting. That makes sense. Yeah. But if we bury you in the weight room and it's like Wednesday before you're recovered again and you got to do technique work on Monday, now we're just impairing the thing that we know is the primary driver to improve the thing that you stated was your number one goal.
Yeah.
And sometimes with lifters, that's hard, right? You know, it's the old question of at one point, do the lifts still transfer or do they stop transferring? And I've talked to Cal Dietz about this endless amounts of times of, you know, as he said, like some of his, you know, back when he was doing back squats years ago, he's like, yeah, we could get a guy or gal, and especially a guy in this case, when they're shot put throwers, to go from back squat of 315 to 405 to maybe 455. But he's like, at some point, they just got worse, right? Because the rate at which they're moving that load is now slower. They're an athlete doing an explosive sport, you know, going from 405 to, say, 455 wasn't beneficial. It's not worth the time. They could take 315 and move it incredibly fast. That's more useful to their sport. Again, if, you know, that athlete can't back squat more than 95 pounds, they're just weak and they need to get stronger.
Yeah.
You're trying to find that happy medium there too.
Yeah. Doug, you notice he didn't say anything about doing split squats. If you tell Mike Nelson that you want to go run a mile, you don't have to do split squats anymore. That's the best. You're on mute. I see you agreeing with me on
yes. The real rationale for training with Mike has surfaced here.
You don't have to be insanely sore doing the trust fall onto the toilet in the morning, because the goal is to get faster, not be sore. Fantastic, man. This has been my favorite show ever. We talked about me being athletic.
Yeah, the whole time.
Incredible. Yeah. Who would have guessed that we could do that for a whole hour? Where can people work with you? Which I also highly recommend. You set a call up with Mike and go over some goals and get a training program built. And it's not just training. That's just the piece that I'm doing. But yeah.
Best place is MikeTNelson.com. And yeah, I have contact place there. Most of the writing, everything I do, goes out to the newsletter. Just go to MikeTNelson.com. There'll be a place you can hop onto the newsletter tab right on the top, and it's free. And yeah, probably 90% of the writing I go is through that. They can just hit reply once they're on the newsletter and ask any questions they have. More than willing to help anyone out.
There you go. Coach Travis Mash, you can find him at Mash Elite. He had to go try and get in better shape so he could hang out with me. Doug Larson.
Man was sick of talking about Anders. He was like, I've had enough. I'm out.
It's like we're going to see a video on him on Instagram in about an hour, front squatting like 500. And just be like, screw that guy.
Screw the bike.
Cardio talker. Like, I thought he was doing cardio now. Yeah. No, still front squatting 500 pounds, 50 years old. right on. You can find me on Instagram at Douglas E. Larson. Mr. Mike T. Nelson, always wonderful to have you on the show, my friend.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. This was super fun.
Absolutely, man. I'm Anders Varner at Anders Varner, and we are Barbell Shrugged at Barbell_Shrugged. Make sure you get over to RapidHealthReport.com. That is where Dr. Andy Galpin and Dan Garner are doing a free lab, lifestyle, and performance analysis that everybody inside Rapid Health Optimization will receive. You can access that free report at RapidHealthReport.com. Friends, we'll see you guys next week.